You'll a URL that you can use to access what I used as the primary source for the discussion that I've put together this evening. I will always try to do that, send you the primary sources. And I always try to go back to the primary source, not read what somebody wrote about the primary source, but actually read the primary source. And the marvel of the internet is if you search long enough, you can find these primary sources. It won't show up on page one of your search results. It'll be on page five, but it is an amazing thing that we can access so much material. And I'll keep trying to do that as we go through our discussion of the restoration movement. We've already kind of established what the religious climate was like in the New England colonies. These are, for the most part, Puritans, people who have left the Church of England. They didn't necessarily want to separate from the Church of England, but they did want to free it of the influences that remained from the period when the Catholics were in charge in England. So when the separatists or the not the separatists, but the Puritans came to America, there were some separatists that came. They established colonies that were in many ways what they thought the ideal government would look like. And we talked about how they enjoyed a very fervent religious life. Religion played such a major role in their lives. Commerce, leisure, everything stopped Saturday afternoon, and all day Sunday was devoted to religious observance. They spent time together. You couldn't leave. It was an absolutely religious day. Now, beyond Sunday, there was a rigorous sense and a broadly exercised church discipline that melded very closely with state discipline. Remember that the church and the state weren't really separated in the Massachusetts colony. Now, a little bit later, we began to separate church and state, but at this point, they're very closely aligned. In fact, in some of the colonies, you paid taxes to support the ministers and the activities of the church. So they had a very rigorous approach to church discipline. And then we talked a little bit about church covenants and how they worked. A church covenant, in order to be a member of the church, of the what they called the visible church. Remember, they distinguished between the visible church and the invisible church, which was the way that some people went about trying to deal with the lack of fervent attitude on the part of some hangers-on. They developed church covenants, and if you were going to be a part of a church, you were expected to participate in the church covenant. And the church covenant was a signed document, and it required certain things before you could be considered a part of a church. There were two things that happened that I think they get out of order, but nevertheless, there are two things that happen. Salvation and baptism. And typically, kids were baptized as infants. So you had salvation, baptism. Those two things are kind of wrapped up together. And then when you became an adult or of age, is the way that they describe it, you had to come before the church and you had to present your conversion narrative. You had to tell the story of your conversion experience. And it's really interesting to read some of those narratives. There aren't many that survive because they tended not to be written down. But the conversion narrative that characterized some of these leaders was written down and preserved for us. And I could get you the URLs so that you could look at some of those conversion narratives, or at least what people remembered about the conversion narrative, what the historians have written about their conversion narrative. So you had to come to the church. You had to present your conversion narrative. You had to present evidence that you were not a scandalous person. That means that you were not involved in any kind of scandal. You had to present evidence of moral purity. And then the church decided whether to accept or reject your conversion story. And you couldn't be a part of the church until all of those things had happened. Now, being a member of a church meant a lot of things. It meant that you had all the rights that pertained to church membership. You could present your children for baptism. You could participate in the Lord's Supper. And yes, they did have closed communion. In other words, if you weren't a member of that church, you could not participate in the Lord's Supper. They would forcefully prevent you from participating. You could have a voice in the choosing of the leadership of the church, and that generally meant the minister. You had all of the civic rights that went along with being in a particular colony. That meant you could vote, you could hold property. There were all kinds of civil rights that were conferred simultaneously with being a church member. Now that's really important. Because some things start to happen. These church covenants, just about all of the first generation that came over to America were participants in the church covenants. Then you had the second generation, the kids that were born here. And then before long, they started having kids. So let me show you how they began to see that there was a problem with these church covenants. First generation, remember, there was salvation, baptism. Those two things kind of went together. Then you had to tell your salvation or your conversion narrative, and it had to be accepted. And then you got all of the rites of church membership, which meant the Lord's Supper and other rites as well. You could present your children to be baptized. And then there were civil rights, civic rights that went along with being a church member. Second generation. Their parents had them baptized when they were infants. Salvation, that happens with God. We don't have much to do with that. But then that second generation tended not to always present themselves or present their conversion narrative. Now, to be as charitable as possible, they didn't present their conversion narrative, maybe because they felt like, well, we've never been through anything like our parents have been through. I mean, their conversion narrative includes getting on a ship and sailing across the Atlantic and all of the hardships that were involved in that, and persisting and this tremendous faith that they had that God was going to take care of them while they were in this new country, and they almost starved to death, and some of the colonies just were wiped out. So people may have felt like, well, I just don't have anything like that in my life that I can talk about. So they never presented their conversion narrative charitably because they didn't really think that they had anything that was comparable to what their parents had done. Now, it could be that they chose not to present their conversion narrative because they didn't want to be tied to the church discipline. They didn't want to run the risk of being publicly shamed or being publicly held to account for something that they had done. So they chose not to become a member of that church. It could be, in some cases, that they presented their conversion narrative and the existing members of the church voted it down. And that happened sometimes. So second generation, they're baptized, no conversion narrative. That means they don't have religious rites. They can't participate in the Lord's Supper. And they could not present their children to be baptized. They couldn't vote. They couldn't own property. All these things happen to the second generation because they didn't present their conversion narrative. They never became what they call in the literature that they wrote, they never became confederated members of a church. Now, third generation comes along. The kids of the first generation have kids. Those are your grandchildren if you're in the first generation. And you expect that they're going to be baptized in the church. Not so. If the second generation wasn't fully in line with the covenant, they couldn't present their children to be baptized. So you can imagine, I mean, if you think you've been part of some wild Thanksgiving dinners, you can imagine what those Thanksgiving dinners were like. And on top of that, the church authorities didn't have any, the church authorities didn't have any enforcement mechanism for the discipline that they wanted to exercise. So you have generational alienation between the first generation, second generation, and the third generation. You have declining visible church membership. You have restricted reach of church discipline. And you have decreased opportunities for civic participation. That's going to lead to a problem. How did they go about resolving this issue? The way that they did it was what's called the halfway covenant. Remember, you could become a church member only after you had reported an experience of conversion that was acceptable to the church, what they called an approved conversion narrative, even if you had been baptized as an infant. So they never converted, or they never rehearsed their conversion narrative. They were still considered church members in the second generation because they'd been baptized as infants based on their parents' church membership. So the second generation was considered church members, kind of, with some restricted rights. But here's the biggie. Their children couldn't be baptized because their parents were not members of the visible church. 1657, a group of ministers led by Solomon Stoddard put together what they called the Halfway Covenant. 1662, there was a synod in Massachusetts. All the leadership of the various churches came together. A church, there was generally speaking one church in a city, or a city, a town, village. They all came together. It happened to be in Boston. And what they decided was, in this halfway covenant, that children of baptized but unconverted church members, that second generation that never reported their narration, their conversion experience, they decided, no, their kids can be baptized. So that their children became church members, children acquired political rights, children were expected then to report their own conversion experience, which was acceptable to the church. The Great Awakening that was led by Jonathan Edwards and others, but Jonathan Edwards is generally accepted to be the leading spokesman for this first Great Awakening, was a response to what, to the halfway covenant that the synod came up with in 1662, because he argued you've let everything go. It's a slippery slope. If you're going to let these people in, then you might as well give up, because no more fervent religious zeal. So what were the parts of this halfway covenant solution? I actually found the proceedings of the synod in 1662 that reflect what the parts of this halfway covenant solution was that they came up with. And I give you the URL so you can look this thing up. This one's even harder to read than the first one that I gave you, because it's, well, the print's not as clear. And there, it's one of those things where their S's look like F's, and there are all kinds of divergent spellings. It hadn't been formalized But they made seven propositions that were intended to answer the question, who are the subjects of baptism? Who can be baptized? Okay? They came up with these statements. First, those that are, according to Scripture, are members of the visible church are the subjects of baptism. Remember, visible church, that has to do with whether you had signed on to the covenant, whether you were actually, you had actually reported your conversion narrative, and they would report the conversion narrative sometimes before they were baptized. So if that was the case, then you became a member of the church when you reported your conversion narrative and the church voted on it and you signed the church covenant, then you could be baptized. That's what the first proposition says. Second proposition. Members of the visible church, according to Scripture, are Confederate visible believers in particular churches and their infant seed. So now if you are a member of the visible church, you can present your child to be baptized. Children in minority whose next parents, one or both, are in covenant. Then, the infant seed of visible believers are members of the same church with their parents. Now, this is interesting. If your parents were members of a particular church and you were born to them, you're considered members of that church. And you are under the discipline, watch, and government of that church. Okay? I'll scoot back over here because that was a little hard for me to read. These adult persons are not therefore to be admitted to full communion. That's why they call it a halfway covenant. They're not admitted to full communion merely because they are and continue members without such further qualifications. In other words, conversion narrative and signing the church covenant as the word of God requireth thereunto. Some of the sentences that they wrote are a little bit hard to follow. Church members who are admitted in minority, as they're admitted as babies because they've been baptized, understanding the doctrine of faith and publicly professing their assent thereto, not scandalous in life, and that means not involved in a scandal of some kind, solemnly owning the covenant before the church, wherein they give up themselves and their children to the Lord and subject themselves to the government of Christ in the church, their children are to be baptized. So there's the change. There's the change. Such church members who either by death or by some other extraordinary providence have been hindered from public acting as aforesaid, yet have given the church cause in judgment of charity to look upon them as so qualified, and such as had they been called thereunto would have so acted, their children are to be baptized. So you're a good person, but for some reason you haven't been able to complete the conversion narrative step. Okay. Now this was referred to pejoratively as a halfway covenant. The synod in 1662 never called this a halfway covenant, but pejoratively, men like Jonathan Edwards and those that were opposed to these halfway covenants, they called it a halfway covenant because they said you're shaking them in through the back door. You're not requiring them to be what they ought to be. So that was where their opposition came from. And then number seven, the members of Orthodox churches being found in the faith, not scandalous in life, presenting due testimony thereof, these occasionally coming from one church to another, which meant you move from one town to another, may have their children baptized in the church whither they came by virtue of communion of churches, but if they move their habitation, they ought orderly to covenant and subject themselves to the government of Christ in the church where they settle their abode, and so their children to be baptized. So if you're coming to a new town, you have to go through the whole process all over again. You have to present your conversion narrative. You don't have to be baptized, but you do have to sign the church covenant. And your children then could be baptized in the church where you were. And then if you came to this new town, they could be baptized there. So those are the seven propositions that made up the synod's answer to the problem of second and third generation kids. Now, it's not fair to say that they just made these things up out of thin air, because if you look at the URL that I sent you, these seven propositions begin on page 17. They continue on to page 18, and then about the middle of page 18 through page 44 is the biblical information that they used and the reasoning that they used to come up with these seven propositions. So they did it with a view to looking at the Bible. But the argument that the reformers made was, well, if you looked at the Bible in the first place and you came up with this plan, what happened that now you're willing to change the plan? The biblical information didn't change. You're worried about declining church membership and you want to keep the membership up. So that's what gives rise to men like Jonathan Edwards and his famous sermon that I'll send you next week. His famous sermon was Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. I mean, he dangled people over the fires of hell when they came to church, and you couldn't leave. You know, and these sermons went on for 3 or 4 hours. So he was quite an orator, but he makes the point. You guys have given up on your conviction to follow God because you saw that church membership was declining, and now you want to shake them in. So that'll explain the church covenants and what gives rise to the First Awakening. Any comments at this point?
Dean?
Yeah.
It seems to me that the chart showed that they had really a built-in obsolescence because of the way things were set up, that the church was going to disappear after a while just because of the way they set it up. Sort of like what happened to the Shakers, who don't believe in marriage. I mean, you know, there are certain things that you make that decision, then you find out, wait a minute, that you don't have any church if you keep doing this. So we must be doing something wrong.
Right. Right. And that was the point that the synod made. The point that the enlightened that the reformed thinkers made was, no, God will preserve the church. You just need to hang in there with your strict requirements. But I agree with you, Carol. They had built a system that guaranteed they were going to go away after just a short period of time. Now, when the reformers came along, you did get this bump in church membership because they were convinced that if you weren't a part of the church, you were going to die in hell. So you got the bump that the reformers said would happen. And that was the first Great Awakening. A return to a religious zeal, a religious fervor. Wasn't without its problems, but that was what happened. And you know, Carol has analyzed this correctly. In my mind, if you have that kind of a religious zealotry, then you almost guarantee that things are going to fall apart. Now, in the established churches, things kind of developed to the point where church membership was more like the formal proceedings in a court of law. And that's why the synod could come together and they could draft this clearly worded statement. But for the people that were saying, hey, look, we need to get back to some zeal here, that was all kind of cold and formal and wasn't very satisfying. So that was a part of it as well. The atmosphere in the established churches became cold and formalized. And in the reformers' churches, there was a lot of zeal. There was a lot of fervency. And that was appealing to at least some people. Because they were saying, hey, if strict requirements means that we're not getting as many people, that's okay. God doesn't want halfway people. If you're not going to go all the way, God doesn't want you, and neither do we. So other questions? Like I said, depending on whether you're reading those that were in favor of the synod's action in 1662, or if you're reading things that were written by people that were opposed to the synod's action, it's either presented as the best thing that ever happened or the worst thing that ever happened. So you need to go back and read the original document to really kind of get a handle on what these folks were actually trying to do.
Dean?
Yeah.
It really confuses me that Jesus died for everybody, but you can't live a scandalous life and belong to and join their church.
That's true. That's true. There were a lot of people that were excluded from church membership. I mean, that's why you get great literature like the Scarlet Letter. The Scarlet Letter is about this time. So if you were a prostitute, you weren't welcome. No matter what happened. They'd have had fits if they, I really don't think Jesus would have been welcome. Okay. Well, we're taking baby steps. Next week, we're going to look at some of the leadership, and we'll look at what happened as a result of their preaching. And that'll get us through kind of the first Great Awakening. And we'll take a couple of weeks break, then we'll come back together and we'll talk about the Second Awakening. But you have to understand what happened in the first one to understand what went on in the second one. Because this whole question of open or closed communion, that question remains one that's debated today. I have seen, or no, I have not seen. I have heard of churches where they passed the Lord's Supper, and if you were not a member of the church, they just didn't pass it to you. And they prevented you from taking it. So, these are questions that are still debated.
Hey, Dean.
Yeah.
I actually, the church that my grandparents went to, who raised my mom, it was a Catholic church. And it didn't dawn to me until tonight when you were talking that my mom had me out of wedlock. So I've always noticed when I was younger that the pastors and the people of the church really never would speak to my mom. They would kind of pretend that she's not there. And I always thought, I was like, why are they being so mean? And then now that you're discussing this tonight, it kind of all makes sense because I was baptized as an infant. They did allow that, but I remember wanting to walk up to get communion with her. So I was like, ooh, a piece of bread. I want some bread. And she was like, no, you can't go. And they wouldn't let her go either. Like, I would go up with her, and they said, no, you need to go sit down.
Yeah. Yeah, you've experienced this firsthand. I've never experienced that.
I never knew why. And even when I would try to go with my grandparents, they would make me go. I remember I was so confused because I would go up with my grandmother, and my grandmother said, sweetie, you have to go sit down. So I was just sitting there by myself waiting for her.
Yep.
Wow. It's kind of sad. Kind of feel bad for my mom now because I always wondered why are they being so rude or so mean? And they just, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, go ahead, Carol.
I was just saying, you know, I've always heard, you know, God always had his church. You know, his church was a remnant, was always there. But if this is the only remnant we read about, I'm not sure how close it was to anything.
Well, but remember, this is just in America. There were Christians that were worshiping all over the world. This is the American experience. And the reason that I discuss the American experience is because that's where we come from. So you're right. It may be that this group had so lost their way that they're no longer God's people. But God has always had people. And when you understand kind of where they were, then you understand a little bit better how early on in the second awakening, they could have had so many erroneous notions. They get on the right track, but there were a lot of things that it just didn't occur to them yet to have a question about that. So they're working through it. Somebody said it's like a man who comes out of a very dark place into the sunlight. And when he comes into the sunlight, he can't see very well. So when you come out of this kind of an environment into the sunlight, even when you have the best of intentions, you are beset with a lot of traditional ways of thinking. And it's, I have to tell you, it's very disquieting to say, we are going to examine every practice that characterizes our group. And I've only done that once, and that was when we were starting a church in Wasilla, and we had people from a lot of different backgrounds, and we said, everything about us is open to question. We're going to look at the biblical information about everything. And that's, when you lay yourself bare like that, that's a really a revealing that's uncomfortable, to say the least. You know, we're going to take the Lord's Supper. How are we going to do it? Are we going to use one container? Are we going to use two containers? Are we going to use multiple containers? Are we all going to break a piece off of the bread? Or just how are we going to do what's required? And you know, we most of the time we come to our practice of religion with a lot of traditions that we've just never questioned. You know, why do we gather on Sunday morning? I've told the story before, when we were starting the church in Wasilla, we actually had the opportunity to say, okay, when are we going to meet? Because we hadn't been meeting before. When are we going to meet? And people said, well, I kind of like meeting at 2:00 in the afternoon. Okay. Is there any biblical information that says that you have to meet at 9 o'clock in the morning? No. So we met at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And do you know, we had folks that came through Wasilla that worshiped with us that thought that that was outrageous, that that was unbiblical. We had to figure out what name we were going to put on the sign. And you hear people say all the time, well, the church doesn't have a name. Okay, let's put up Christ's Church Meets Here. And you'll find out that people, you know, they're not comfortable saying, well, I don't want to do that. But the church doesn't have a name. So it's important to understand these things. And I'm not advocating that we take down the sign out in front. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just saying, let's be open to understanding why we do what we do and figure out whether that's required or not. And we can have preferences too. We could very easily put up a sign that said, Disciples of Christ Meet Here. Okay, we're about out of time, guys. We will take up with Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God next week.